Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate
vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 13, Dhritarashtra quits home, text 44. Yanmana Shadruvam Lokam. Aduruvam Vanako Bayam. Savatanahi Sochaste. Snehad anyatra mohayat. Yat. Even though. Manyase. You think. Dhruvam. Absolute truth. Lokam. Persons. Adhruvam. Non-reality. Va. Either. Na. Or not. Cha. Also. Ubayam, or otherwise, sorry, or bothwise. Savata, in all circumstances. Na, never. He, certainly. Soyat, subject for lamentation. Te, they. Snehat, due to affection. Anyatra, or otherwise. Mohayat, due to bewilderment. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. O King, in all circumstances, whether you consider the soul to be eternal principle, to be an eternal principle, or the material body to be perishable, or everything to exist in the impersonal absolute truth, or everything to be inexplicably combination of matter and spirit, feelings of separations are due only to illusory affection and nothing more. Translation responsively. O King, in all circumstances, whether you consider the soul to be an eternal principle, or the material body to be perishable, or everything to exist in the impersonal absolute truth, or everything to be an inexplicable combination of matter and spirit. Feelings of separation are due only to illusory affection and nothing more. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The actual fact is that every living being is an individual part and parcel of the Supreme Being, and his constitutional position is subordinate cooperative service. Either in his conditional material existence or in his liberated position of full knowledge and eternity, the living entity is eternally under the control of the Supreme Lord. But those who are not conversant with the factual knowledge put forward many speculative propositions about the real position of the living entity. It is admitted, however, by all schools of philosophy that the living being is eternal, and that the covering body of the five material elements is perishable and temporary. The eternal living entity transmigrates from one material body to another by the law of karma, and material bodies are perishable by their fundamental structure. Therefore, there is nothing to be lamented in the case of a soul being transferred into another body, or the material bodies perishing at a certain stage. There are others also who believe in the merging of the spirit soul in the Supreme Spirit when it is uncovered by the material encagement. And there are others also who do not believe in the existence of the spirit soul, in the existence of spirit or soul, but believe in tangible matter. In our daily experience, we find so many transformations of matter from one form to another, but we do not lament such changing features. In either of the above cases, the forces of divine energy is uncheckable. No one has any hand in it, and thus there is no cause for grief. Om Agyana Timiranda Shyaganandjana Shalakya Chakshuramiri Tanyana Tasna Shri Guru Venu. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutalaya Shimadi Hridaya Nanda Goswami Niti Namane. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutalaya Shimadi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Devam Gaudavani Kacharani Nevisesi Shunivadi Prashachari Shachani. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichamanda Shri Advaita Gavatar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakti Vrinda. Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. It's funny that we should have this verse today, because yesterday I had to attend a funeral, which was really interesting, and it was full of lamentation and suffering. Which was a really, you know, people may have plans as far as what their life journey is going to be. And in this case, this was an interesting scenario. Some of you may know my mother is very elderly, she's 96 years old. And she has these people that come around to visit her and look after her, you know, well-meaning people. And in two circumstances, people that are much younger than my mother passed away before her. They were rendering service to her, thinking that she only has a short period of time to live, and that we'll do some service for her. And that both those people passed away before her. So I had to take my mother to their funeral as opposed to them going to my mother's funeral. So in these funerals, this point of attachment is just so strong. It's just amazing, you know, the connection that people form, and there's such a pulling power for people that have passed away. It's always such a sad thing. And it was interesting to note that after going to that funeral and then reading this passage from the Srimad Bhagavatam, where Prabhupada says, the actual fact is that every living being is an individual part and parcel of the Supreme, and his constitutional position is subordinate cooperative service. It's really an interesting phrase. Subordinate cooperative service. So we're always under his supervision. So I was thinking about this, and there were a couple of points that I wanted to bring up. First of all, above and beyond everything, I'm just so happy to be back in Melbourne. We had a wonderful time, didn't we? in India, and also we had spent a little bit of time in Bangkok, in Thailand. But the Indian exhibition was really amazing. We met some wonderful people. And we had some really nice association with some of the Melbourne devotees. It's always good when you see a Melbourne devotee. We went to Mayapur, and there was a couple of young brahmacharis that used to stay in Bhakta Bhavan who were there. And, Bhakta Prabhu, you know, like so close. So when we talk about attachments and connections, when it comes to devotees, that's such a transcendental spiritual thing, that you see one another from your hometown or whatever, and there's such a strong bond, you know. And this devotee, and I honestly can't remember his name, I just remember his face. He was a tall devotee that used to live in the ashram, and another devotee as well. Such nice devotees. They can't come back to Australia, they can't get a permanent residency. So he had brought his mum and dad to India, to Mayapur, and to check out the Mayapur temple. And his mum and dad were so pleased to meet me, and you know, it was just such a nice connection, you know. So spiritual connections are a different thing, but what I witnessed yesterday was this material attachment to the, that they had no further knowledge as to where they were going to go or where. And then the thing was, as Prabhupada is pointing out here, they put forward many speculative propositions about the real position of the living entity. You know, you have these professional orators or people that do the service at one of these funerals, and they come up with such mushy stuff about the soul and how it's gone on to a greater destiny, and she lived life and she wants you to all to be happy, and it just went on and on, and it was just like, you know, there's no substance to it, no truth to it. We as devotees are so fortunate that we understand what the situation is. We get that information from the Shastras, from this Vedic culture. And I was reading in the 15th chapter, text 7, where it says, Mai vamsa jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana manasashtam indriyani prakriti stana kashti. The living entity in his conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts, as is pointed out in this purport. Due to conditioned life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses. Again, this is mentioned in the purport, which includes the mind. So every living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, which is again pointed out here. Haribol, how are you? And it's quite unnatural for them to live in this material world. It is unnatural for us to be here. We don't belong here. We want to live forever. We want to be happy forever. We want complete knowledge. And none of those things are available to us while we're in this material engagement. So the living entity struggles for existence in the material world, and it's a wrong struggle because the spirit soul cannot be happy with any amount of material pleasure. It cannot be happy. It cannot be eternally happy. The example that it brought home to me so clearly, like when we came back from India, we thought, okay, after India, it was a very austere trip in a number of ways, except when we met the devotees from Melbourne. And you know, the last part in Mayapur was really nice. But before that, I mean, everything was nice, but we were jam-packed with service. When we were in Tirupati, we had conferences from about 9 o'clock in the morning to about 8 o'clock at night, you know, just discussing how we're going to do communication work and then meeting with the GBC and all this kind of stuff. So it was really intense. And this was all new to me and Bhakti. An interesting thing about Bhakti, went along just for the ride, so to speak, you know, in a sense. She was helping me. And then we were in Tirupati, and my superior, the Minister for Communications, he's the Vice Chairman of the GBC, who's my boss, Anuttama. He needed a secretary for this communication portfolio. And so I was there as a representative for Australia, as a communications director for Australia. And he said, "What's your wife doing?" And I said, "Well, she's gone with Ajita's wife. They're going to do some sari buying and having a look at some of the temples and all this kind of stuff." He said, "Is she any good at secretarial work?" I said, "She does all my secretarial work, and you know, she works with me with communications. Has she got any idea on making magazines?" "Yes, she does a magazine for the Hindu community and so on and so forth." So he said, "Ask her if she would be the communications secretariat for the GBC." I asked her. "Yeah, I'll do that," she said. So now my wife is my boss. She's the secretary for Anuttama and for the communications internationally. So this was a real opportunity for her. So it was pretty intense. So what we thought was, okay, after this intensity of the travelling in India and all the seminars and conferences and everything, we'll take a break in Bangkok. It's a flight path back. And Bhakti said, "You know, I want to go shopping. I want to buy some jewellery for the deities, because you can get very expensive jewellery there. But, you know, you actually visit this place and it is just 100% on the bodily platform. There's practically zero amount of spirituality there, you know. It is so on the bodily platform. The ladies, you know, are very, in a sense, very indecent in the way they dress, their attitude to life. It's just sexually orientated. Sex is a big part of their lives." And it was actually really an eye-opener. And it's absolutely no place for a renunciate. If you're sort of focusing just on... You have to be a really fixed-up devotee to be living there, I'm sure, you know. But this was just such an incredibly bodily platform place. So anyway, that was interesting. And also in India, we saw, you know, everybody's struggling for a place in this world materially. I hadn't been for 5 years since I went to India the last time, and then before that I hadn't been for 18 years. But the changes to their thinking, to people's thinking in India, is actually quite horrific. They're really changing. They're completely forgetting their Vedic roots, their Vedic culture. They're so into materialism, you know. If you switch on the TV there, they have a half an hour of advertisements now between, you know, like here in Australia, you watch the news or something and you get 2 or 3 minutes of ads. In India, you watch a news program or something, and then there's like 30 minutes of ads. You need this for your home. You need this for your kid. You need this for your car. You need this, this. Did you happen to watch any of the TV at all? It was like, my God. And then out there, everybody is just so into material consciousness. It's amazing. Which is really a shame. It's, you know, they're wanting to enjoy material pleasures. But as it's pointed out here, there is no way that you're going to be able to satisfy these material desires in any way, shape or form. So the basic principle of present-day civilization is to enjoy and exploit the material world to the highest possibility. And this is so obvious now throughout the world. That exploitation of the material world is just coming to a point where it's really affecting each and every one of us. Again, as I mentioned, in India and also in Bangkok, things like pollution. It is just so thick with pollution. The whole time we were in Calcutta in particular, they're cleaning up a little bit, but there's still a lot of pollution. You feel it on your throat, you know. And the only way that they survive is through air-conditioned buildings everywhere, air-conditioned buildings. And I mean, you know what air conditioning goes through. They have to be kept really clean or otherwise they affect you as well. Same in Bangkok. The smog in the city was just so incredible. It was like a constant thick haze of smog around the city. So much so that if you drove around in one of those tuk-tuks or rickshaw type things, or in a taxi even, they all say, wind up your windows so the air, you know, you have air conditioning. And your throat was just aching. My throat is still, and each morning I'm coughing up phlegm, you know, this, and you come home with this sort of a cough. It's just pollution. It's just, it's incredible. So one of the first things when we came back to good old Melbourne town was we were at Tullamarine Freeway, Tullamarine Airport, and our son picked us up and it was like, oh, fresh air, you know, it's like actual real air, you know, it's so, so pleasing. So this is a wrong civilization. This place is just heading in the wrong direction. And it needs to have a different direction. And this is where the devotees come in. We have to take on this incredible challenge. So I just wanted to read, as I mentioned, the first chapter, 15th chapter. In the 15th chapter, Srila Prabhupada points out, now this is the chapter on Yoga of the Supreme Person. I just want to read a couple of the verses. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, it is said that there is an imperishable banyan tree that is, has its roots upwards and its branches down, and whose leaves are the Vedic hymns. One who knows this tree is the knower of the Vedas. The next verse goes on to explain, the branches of this tree extend downwards and upwards, nourished by the three modes of material nature. The twigs are the objects of the senses. This tree also has roots going down, and these are bound to fruitive actions of human society. The real form of this tree cannot be perceived in this world. No one can understand where it ends and where it begins or where its foundation is. But with determination, one must cut down this strongly rooted tree with the weapon of detachment. So we have to remove ourselves from this connection. Thereafter, one must seek that place from which, having gone, one never returns. So back to our real destiny, the spiritual world. And there surrender to that Supreme Personality of Godhead from whom everything began and from whom everything has extended since time immemorial. Those who are free from false prestige, illusion, false association, who understand the eternal, who are done with material lust, who are free from the dualities of happiness and distress, and who, unbewildered, know how to surrender unto the Supreme Person, attain that eternal kingdom. So this is the key. We have to free ourselves from false prestige, pride, illusion and false association, and understand our true nature. Now I just wanted to read the purport that Prabhupada says here. The surrendering process is described here very nicely. The first qualification is that one should not be deluded by pride. And I'm going to go into this a little bit more. Because the conditioned soul is so puffed up, thinking himself the lord of material nature, it is very difficult for him to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should know by the cultivation of real knowledge that he is not the Lord of the material nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Lord. When one is free from the delusion caused by pride, he can begin the process of surrender. So we have to eliminate our pride first, and then we can start to surrender. For one who is always expecting some honour in this material world, it's not possible to surrender to the Supreme Person. Pride is due to illusion. For although one comes here and stays for a brief time and then goes away, he has the foolish notion that he is the Lord of the world. So somehow or other, we think we can control. We're here for such a flash in the pan. This lady actually that passed away, who's the friend of my mother's, she was a real dominating little doer, you know. She thought she could take care of everything. Like even when she was diagnosed with breast cancer, she said, "Oh no, I'll be okay, I'll be okay." Within 2 weeks she had passed away. So all the intentions she may have, Krishna can snuff it out. The whole world moves under this impression. People are considering the land, this earth, to belong to human society. They have divided the land under false impressions that they are the proprietors. And you see all the strife that's happening in the Middle East. You know, this rotten little bit of land, the Gaza Strip, and they're fighting against Israel, another rotten piece of land, desert land. And they're fighting, shooting rockets backwards and forwards. "This is my land." "No, it's my land. It's my land. It's my land." It's like little kids in the sand pit. "Give me my toy. Give me my toy." When one is free from such false notions, he becomes free from all false associations caused by familial, social, and national affections. These faulty associations bind one to this material world. Again, that's what was pointed out in this purport. And after this stage, one has to develop spiritual knowledge. One has to cultivate knowledge of what is actually his own and what is actually not his own. And when one has an understanding of things as they are, he becomes free from all dual concepts such as happiness and distress, pleasure and pain. He becomes full in knowledge, and then it is possible for him to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we have to realize who is actually the proprietor. And one of the things that we really have to get rid of, and this is what was pointed out by Srila Prabhupada, is this pride. We have to deal with this on a daily basis. We all have it. We all think that somehow or other we're the Lord of this whole world. Even as devotees, we still battle with this pride. When one is free from such a false notion, he becomes free from all false associations caused by familial, social, national, and these fake associations bind one to this material world. There's a little story that I wanted to point out that I read recently about pride. Not long ago, there was a CEO, a managing director of a Fortune 500 company. Everybody know what a Fortune 500 company is? It's one of the wealthiest companies, right? So he's one of the top CEOs of his company. So not long ago, there was a CEO of a Fortune 500 company who pulled up into a service station to get gas. He went inside to pay, and when he came out, he noticed his wife engaged in deep discussion with a service station attendant. It turned out that she knew him. In fact, back in high school, before she'd met her eventual husband, the CEO, she used to date this man. And this CEO got in the car, and the two drove off in silence. Later, he said, feeling pretty good about himself, he said, I bet I know what you're thinking. I bet you're thinking that you're glad that you married a Fortune 500 CEO, and not to him, that service station attendant, you know. So, and she turned around to him and said, "No, I was thinking if I married him, he would be the Fortune 500 CEO, and you'd be the service station attendant." So, pride can be a really ugly thing. It can be a really ugly thing. And when we're proud, we deliberately choose not to acknowledge Krishna. We choose not to have him as Lord in our life. So I wrote down a few points about pride. When we have pride, instead we exalt our own ways of doing things, and we say to God, "I'll do this my way. Don't interfere in my life." So these are the, you know, as is pointed out in this purport, we think of all these different ways for God not to get involved in our life. But if you do not know God is immeasurably superior to all of us, then we cannot know him personally. We have to understand first and foremost that God is our superior, that everything comes from him. Pride alienates us from others. If we judge others and deem them to be inferior to us, we become crippled in our ability to relate to them. Hello. Thank you for good. Wow, I needed that. A little bit of pride. So, pride wrecks relationships. It sets husband against wife, again, parents against children, friend against worker, against the boss. In our pride, we become isolated and alone. So this is something that we have to really mind out. Pride can actually wreak havoc in our lives. Then, you know, I mean, it brings about arguments in our marriage. Marriages, so many times you take a position of pride. And the best way to stop arguments, actually Bhakti and I only had one argument the whole time that we were in India, which was really amazing. We were so proud of each other that we only had one argument. And that was, I honestly tried to be as humble as I can to go shopping. Now, I don't know about you guys as far as men are concerned, but shopping is not really my forte. Now, we're in Bangkok, right? And Bhakti had placed us in a hotel which was right in the middle of all the markets. Right? So, you know Victoria Market, multiply that 100 times, and that was the market in Bangkok. Our hotel was right in the middle, with every conceivable jewellery, necklace, tiaras, everything for the deities that you could ever think of, you know. And we had a limited budget, and there's Bhakti going from shop to, you know, store to store, picking out this little earring, and that one will match, that's it, and this one. So I lasted 2.5 days, and I thought that was pretty good. She said, I need you here because you're my protection. I said, for God's sake. After 2.5 days, I said, that's it. No more earrings. I've had enough. My pride got in the way, and I said, I'm going back to the hotel. So there was only one argument, the whole thing. So, actually, Anuttama Prabhu brought up a really interesting scenario as far as arguments between husband and wife. He said, the best way to stop pride in marriage is to take a humble approach. So anybody that's considering marriage, you should remember this one. And the story that he told, he said, in our marriage, we made a rule. And he said, because I'm the head of the family, I take care of all the big decisions that we have to make. And the wife takes care of all the small decisions. The wife also gets an opportunity to determine which are the small decisions and which are the big decisions. That's taking the humble role. I thought, that is such a good opportunity to remember in marriage. So symptoms of pride can be likened to cancer. Everybody understands the insidious nature of cancer. At first we're unaware of the cancer, and if it grows silently within our bodies, and then we realise something isn't right, we ignore it, the cancer becomes all-consuming, and before you know it, you're dead with cancer. And so it is with pride. Once we recognise the symptoms of pride in our lives, we have two choices. We can ignore it and let the symptoms and the pride destroy us, or we can go to Krishna and ask him to show us to what extent this pride has overtaken us, because it's a lethal disease. So it is with pride. Srila Prabhupada says, one has to cultivate knowledge of what actually is his own and what is actually not his own. And when one has that understanding of things as they are, he becomes free from all dualities, such as happiness and distress, pleasure and pain, becomes full of knowledge, and then it is possible for him to surrender to the Supreme. So some of the symptoms of pride, if we can just, I just analysed a few things, if you bear with me. The first thing is stealing from God's glory, stealing from Krishna's glory. To have an honest estimation and understanding of our God-given gifts and ability is not pride. To have an honest estimation and understanding of our God-given gifts and ability is not pride. Such an assessment is necessary if we are to develop the talents that God has invested in us. So each one of us has certain talents that we can utilize in service to the Supreme Lord. However, it is dangerous to form pride that causes us to take credit for the gifts that God has given us. So if you're particularly good in making garlands or ghee wicks or anything, we have to really see that this gift has been given to us by God. We have to use that and not become proud of that. The second one is self-centeredness. If in the exercising our spiritual gifts and natural abilities, which we all have, we ride over the feelings of others and insist in getting our own way, then we need to re-examine our gifts. If we're not using our abilities to bring blessings to others, then we're misusing those gifts. You get that? So we've got these wonderful gifts that Krishna has given to us, but if we override others, if we don't give others an opportunity to also learn how to do these gifts, some of us may be more talented in making garlands, for example, and someone may be a bit slow in the uppick of how to do it and how to form them, you know, so on and so forth. If we then say, oh look, forget about it, don't worry, I'll do it, that's pride getting in our way. So we have to be really careful with that. The next one is a demanding spirit. The pride of a demanding spirit is revealed by his constantly bringing attention to things that have not been done for him or her, rather than things that have been done. In demanding that people do things our way all the time, we are saying, I am superior. Always asking people, you know, do it my way. My way is the best way. The next part is superiority. Pride causes us to believe that we are more important than others and look down on them. Such haughtiness reveals a belief that somehow we are closer to Krishna or better than other people's because of our doctrine, how much knowledge we know, how much shastra we have, our actions and intrinsic worth. So this is a superiority. Sometimes we think, oh, I'm such a bigger devotee than that person, and I know so many more shlokas, or I have such a better grasp on who Krishna is. And that again is a way of pride getting in the way. The next one, which is something that we all do at times, is sarcasm. Caustic comments may be socially acceptable, but they have no place in Krishna consciousness. Sarcasm is a thinly veiled attempt to impress people by highlighting the faults of others in a pseudo-humorous way. You know, that we, oh, he's not that good at doing that, you know, whatever. So sarcasm is something that we in Krishna consciousness really can't tolerate. And again, it's a form of pride. A judgmental and critical attitude. People who are critical and judgmental have difficulty seeing good in others. Being judgmental, you have difficulty in seeing good in others when they are confronted with it and are quickly negated through comparison. In judging another person, we are saying, I can do it better. Why don't they just move over and let me do it? So again, this whole judgmental, critical attitude. Another point of pride is impatience. Being impatient, we signify that our ideas, projects, programs, schedules are more important than other people's. Many times we have to wait on others. We become impatient at such times, regardless of who is at fault. It is never justified. So impatience is never justified. So when you feel that coming up in yourself, when you feel these different things coming up in yourself, then you can realize, ah, that's pride. So if you have, you know, oh, why don't you do this a little quicker, you know? Why don't you just get on with it? Instead of being assisting and helping, that again is pride coming in. The next one is unteachable spirit. To have an unteachable spirit. None of us is above the need for correction. All of us need to be corrected in some areas of our lives. When we're confronted, do we listen when someone is correcting us? Or do we ignore what a person is telling us and we accept reproof? Or do we become aloof and resentful that somebody dared to tell us something that was wrong with our character or wanted to correct us? If we lay aside our pride, we will benefit from insights of many wise people. If you just put that aside, even Prabhupada said, you know, you can learn from an animal even. There are different things that we can learn. And especially when we're dealing with interfaith groups, you know, I can take the attitude, well, we have the superior knowledge, we have Vedic culture, everything is explained. If you have that unteachable spirit, again, it's a level of pride. But so often we have it in our dealings with interfaith people that some real pearls of wisdom are given to us that we can relate in a Krishna conscious way. So we have to be teachable. We have to open ourselves that we can find knowledge from many, many places. The last one is self-pity. Again, it's a form of pride. Self-pity results when one is clinging to our hurt, when we cling to something that is hurting us, frustrations and disappointments, instead of turning our problems over to the Lord, understanding where those problems are coming from, understanding that it's a karmic reaction, it's a purificatory thing, we actually hang on to these hurts and frustrations. We do this because we enjoy the attention that comes when someone is feeling sorry for us. Oh, you poor thing. And because we think we can, so this is also another area that we have to be really mindful of, this act of self-pity. And we also think that we can deal with our problems ourselves. Oh, I'll handle it. I'll be alright. Instead of turning it over to the Lord or to His servants. You know, and that's the point that within Krishna consciousness we reveal our minds to one another. So this is also a point of pride. It is possible in our fallen materialistic and deceitful human heart to become victorious over this pride, as is pointed out. Our focus doesn't have to be on trying to reduce the pride, but in fact what we try to do is increase humility, which is the opposite of pride. And so this is something that we have to really be mindful of. Now, how do you define humility? People have a concept, an idea of humility. Humility is not being embarrassed by the disclosure of one's worst sins. So if somebody's pointing out some things to you, you don't become completely... It's not that. It does not come from being shamed publicly. Humility is not a form of self-hatred, nor is it a low estimation of our gifts and our talents. So we shouldn't feel, you know... If you're talented in a particular area, understanding that that talent comes from Krishna, it's not that we suppress that. It is also not an aesthetic withdrawal from the world, falsely renouncing the world, and it's also not a mystical thing. What then is humility? Humility is a dependence, as is pointed out again in this purport, a dependence on God, on Krishna. Humility is acknowledging our absolute and total dependence on the Supreme Lord and daily looking to Krishna as the source of forgiveness and mercy and looking to Him as a direction, as a guide, and also feeling that connection with Krishna through the spiritual master. And one is given counsel by the spiritual master in a direction in one's life and being able to accept that direction and guidance. That's humility. Humility is a longing in our hearts for a loving relationship with the Supreme Lord, Bhakti Yoga. Really wanting to love the Supreme. Humility is a willingness to be honest with ourselves, to be really honest with ourselves, and to be known for who we really are. Don't put up a false image of who you are. Just be yourself. Be your real self. And really find who that real self is. And that's humility. Honesty about our shortcomings should be our way of life. For example, if we fail to fulfill our responsibilities in our service, we should admit that we were wrong and ask for forgiveness. That happens to all of us. If you've done something wrong in your service, just be free and open to admit it. Don't try and justify the mistake. All these different things. Humility is a realistic Krishna conscious view of ourselves. A realistic Krishna conscious view of ourselves. understanding that the Lord has given us certain gifts. We're all unique in the eyes of God. We all have a place within in the Krishna consciousness movement within this world, and that place is to serve Him, love Him, and present this philosophy to others. A classic example of this realistic Krishna conscious understanding is when I had the opportunity. This was really the first time that I had the opportunity to have association with the gurus, with the parampara, the people that have followed on from Srila Prabhupada, in a setting which was not in the awe and reverence sort of setting. So at these GBC meetings with the strategic planning, all of the following on gurus from Srila Prabhupada were there. Devamrita Swami, Jayapataka Swami, Bhakti Charu, Radhanath Swami, Shivaram Swami, and you didn't see them in the role of guru. When they come here, they're in the role of guru. Everyone has awe and reverence for them. But in this setting, they were just simpler. And you really saw their humility. You know, you really saw their genuine, realistic, Krishna conscious nature, which for me was just a wonderful thing to actually see. How humble these people are. How surrendered they are to Krishna. And it goes back also from my Christian upbringing, where Jesus said that whoever then humbles himself as a child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So often we are given this understanding that to be as humble as a child is so simple, so humble. So you felt that simplicity within these great men and women who were there at this GBC forum. Another example which really dawned on me while I was travelling overseas as far as humility is concerned is the humility of Srila Prabhupada. When I was in Calcutta, I had the opportunity to go to his birthplace. I wanted to find out where Srila Prabhupada took birth. And just the most amazing thing. Yeah, they took me out to the back streets of Calcutta. Everybody been to Calcutta here? Very basic sort of place. Very, you know, basic. Rural, rustic, or you know, rough sort of place. So in the back streets of Calcutta, they took me with a little taxi, and there we've purchased this house now where Prabhupada was brought. Well, Prabhupada's mother went there to give birth to Prabhupada, and apparently Prabhupada's mother's family owned a whole section of land in that area of Calcutta. And Prabhupada was born under this tree, a jackfruit tree, in Calcutta. And it's the most simple, basic sort of place. And I grabbed, actually, he said, this isn't the real tree, the house where his mother lived, but the tree is down the road a little bit where Prabhupada was born. And but it's owned by Muslims at the moment, and we're wanting to purchase that house as well. But we can't go there because otherwise they'll put the price up. If they know that ISKCON wants to buy it, they'll put the price up. So we sneakily went around the back streets and I grabbed a leaf of that jackfruit tree where Prabhupada was born. But again, it just, you know, when you're there in Calcutta, it's just so humble. How this personality who has changed the course of human nature, who has changed the course of human society, and that's what Prabhupada has done. You know, with the humble, simple place where he was first conceived, you know, brought into this world, is just an amazing realization, you know. And one other thing which was really interesting, just alongside the place of birth where Prabhupada took birth, and he spent a lot of his youth with his mother's house there, his grandmother's house, there's a little temple which they have programs. And the Radha Govinda deities. And the did you see those Radha Govinda deities? No? And the Radha Govinda deities are almost exactly the same as Radha Vallabha. Mm-hmm. Govinda also has concha wives. Mm-hmm. And so that's why Prabhupada had such a close connection to Melbourne Temple, because the deities here in Melbourne Temple reminded him so much of his childhood deities in Calcutta. When he was just a little child in his grandmother's house, they used to go to this temple. And there were the temples. So when he mustered, I'll show you a photo, I'll put it up on Facebook. And it was, because we took photographs, and it's just like a little Radha Balaban. It was just really amazing. So this is the humility. And Srila Prabhupada in so many ways, it showed, although he was small in stature, he was just a small man, he seemed larger to us. Even now when you watch the videos of Srila Prabhupada, the way he walks, he seems 10 foot tall, you know, he's such a big man. He always held his head up high. He moved with purpose and confidence. You know, when you see him walking on Juhu Beach and chanting, he's so proud, so strong, but not proud in a negative way, in a very positive way. He always spoke in a straightforward way. He cut through all the nonsense with conviction and courage. His actions were bold and daring. What he chose to do, I mean, how bold and daring was it that he told his disciples to build the biggest temple in the world in Sridhar Mayapur? And any of you that haven't seen this incredible temple, you're in for a treat. We saw the infrastructure at the moment, and it is just amazing. It is huge. Those of you that have seen the Samadhi and think that that's wonderful, this is just like way bigger. And Sad Bhuj, who was a devotee, who became a devotee here in Melbourne Temple and was the temple secretary for a number of years, he's the CEO of this project and he's running the whole program. He showed me right through the whole place. Bhakti and I went through and we took photographs and everything. And even now, if we were standing in the temple room where the deities are going to be, and the Nrisinga altar is at the back, and the cosmology temple is at the front. He said, even now, as we stand here, this temple is not going to be big enough. It is huge, but it's not going to be big enough. Thousands of people come through this Mayapur on a daily basis. When we were there, were you there when the Swiss people came through? Yeah, we saw them. There's a boat, like boatloads of tourists now come up the Ganges, they get off the boat into a little boat and then they come into Mayapur and have a look at Mayapur and the temple and everything and hop back on their boat and take off again. It's just amazing. And this is just increasing and increasing. So this is a wonderful situation.
So many buses.
Oh, and buses, all the time buses coming through. So this is by the grace of His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. This small man who had incredible talents, born in the most humble of places, and to be able to achieve a worldwide society that is just blooming and bursting out all over. It's just amazing. And then the creator of the next generation of personalities that are so competent and so humble and so pure in themselves. So his humility is exemplified, and I just wanted to finish up with that. In his prayer when he boarded the ship when he first came to the United States from India, "O Lord, I am just a puppet in your hands. So if you brought me here to dance, then make me dance, make me dance. O Lord, make me dance as you like. I have no devotion, nor do I have any knowledge, but I have strong faith in the holy name of Krishna. I've been designated Bhaktivedanta, and now, if you like, you can fulfill the real purpose of Bhaktivedanta." With great humility, Prabhupada finished his letter, signed "the most unfortunate, insignificant beggar, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami." Now, on the one hand, his prayer shows that Prabhupada has feelings, very lowly, humble feelings, but on the other hand, he is confident that he can do anything by the grace of the Lord. So you've got this mixing of both incredible humility, but then understanding that Krishna can empower him to do anything, and the result is seen. So the prayer also gives us the key to developing qualities of pure devotion. Faith in the holy name of Krishna is the most important point. Our strong faith in the holy name's ability to transform our material consciousness, that can get rid of the pride, that can root out all the different attachments. The more we apply ourselves to the process of this chanting, and that's one thing that I really learnt from our trip, that we really have to hone in on this chanting of the holy names of God, really make it a meditative thing. We will chant with much more focus and attention, and we can and will carefully avoid the offences that hinder our spiritual path. Yes. We'll be less likely to exploit others when we see ourselves as servants and see others also as true spiritual sparks of God. So we see our brothers and sisters as spiritual sparks. We are glorified sparks of spiritual energy with all good qualities, and yet we feel tiny in the presence of the greatest, our Supreme Lord Krishna. We feel tiny when we're in front of Gaur-Nitai, when we get an opportunity to worship the deities. We feel tiny in front of Jagannath Ji, Baladev and Subhadra. And we feel tiny in front of Radha Balava. These are incarnations of Krishna right here, and we're just tiny, infinitesimal little sparks wanting to serve Him. With this true knowledge, the pure soul can have the highest level of self-esteem with the humility all simultaneously. So we can have a high level of self-esteem and humility, just as Srila Prabhupada has showed us. This is what's required. So it was a wonderful opportunity. I met some great people, some wonderful Vaishnavas. We had great association. But in the same token, I'm incredibly glad to be back home, back in the Melbourne Temple. Because this is our solitude here. These are our friends and our loved ones here. And together we can actually build at developing our Krishna consciousness together, helping each other in so many ways, in loving ways. So I'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Any comments or questions, quick ones? Yes, please. Interesting. Good question. Thanks for that. So Arjuna's situation was that he was reflecting his sinful life from the past. And that's quite healthy. That's recommended that we do that. If we go over our own lives, we can see we did so many different things, which we are not doing anymore. And so that review is really a healthy thing. It's not that we beat ourselves up over the fact that you used to slaughter and eat animals when you were... The spiritual master has taken that away from you. When you take initiation, all those things, all those nonsense things that we did in the past, they all become eradicated. And you now get the opportunity to serve the Supreme Lord in pure heart. So we don't have to lament about those things anymore. It's good that we understand we're never going to go back to those things again. Intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, meat eating and so on. And we stay with that. The self-pity, as far as pride is concerned, is a self-pity when things happen to us. And principally, we find most people become a little bit full of self-pity when we're afflicted with an illness or something like that. You know? Or something is not going right in a marriage or a relationship. And then you notice, and a certain amount of companionship and a certain amount of counselling, we all need that. And that's why within devotional service we reveal our mind to people that are godly, to a person that you can trust. But when you sort of wholesale advertise the fact, oh, I'm so sick, I've been sick for so long, I've got this problem, I've got that problem, I've got that problem, and it continues on. Without real knowledge of understanding, why are you sick? Why do you think you have this cold, or why do you think you stubbed your toe, or why do you think such and such happened? It's a part of the whole process of purification, of karmic reaction. Like just recently, there was another incident in Mayapur. Because you think that somehow or other You're drawing attention to you. You're wanting somebody to draw, to give their attention to you, that you are the focus of their attention. That's a different thing. Like I said, there are times within our Krishna consciousness that we have to seek help from someone. We may have a psychological problem, we may have a material problem, we may have a financial problem, and we seek out that godly person that can actually help us. That could be the guru, it could be a shiksha guru, it could be a very dear friend, so on and so forth. So we seek that person out to find information. But if we use that predicament that we're in to highlight ourselves, to advertise the fact, oh, I'm so ill, oh, I've got this, oh, I've got that, and you talk to this person about it, you talk to that person about it, you talk to this person about it, then it becomes a point of pride in that you're wanting their attention. Focus your attention on me. Look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. That's a problem. So with knowledge you actually start...
It's not said out of desperation and out of need for help.
Mm-hmm.
That you'll give out.
That's right. But if you sincerely need help, which we all do at some time, then we have to open ourselves up and be willing to be able to take the instruction that's coming. And that was another part of this problem. We actually have to be able to be taught. So if someone comes up to us, like there was a classic example when I did the chaplaincy with this boy in hospital who had that illness. He was burning up from the inside. All he was doing was saying, oh, why me, why me, this is hurting so much, blah blah blah. And then when I started to talk to him about, well, this is due to your karma and this is past reactions, you know, from Vedic culture, from reading Bhagavad Gita, that nothing comes to you untoward, it was actually something you'd done in the past, now you have to be able to deal with it, then by the fact of his realizing that, he started to heal, because it took away that pride, that sort of connection, look at me type of thing, you know. Yeah. So we have to be really mindful. There's no harm. It's also false humility if there is something wrong with you that you suffer in silence. You know, oh, I'll just tolerate this, Prabhu, because I'm so humble, I'll tolerate it. That's false pride also. So you have to also see, oh, there's something wrong, let me go to an authority that can help me. That's normality. But when it becomes a point of gaining someone's attention, just an attention-seeking thing, then it's fine. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions? Jai Prabhu. Thanks for listening to me. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.